This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 251 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I think this week I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are you?
Which one are you unsure of? If you're David Vanderhoof or where you are?
I think where I am, because evidently I said that John Glenn broke the sound barrier on Monday night on our other show. So I got John Glenn and Glamorous Glennis all confused. So, you know, it gets timely where you get all this confusion.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought you were revealing a little known bit of trivia, but I guess it was a misspeak instead. But, well, it'll help people talk.
That's right. It gives people stuff to complain about on our Slack web pages. But I guess we should get going with our show. We've got a first civilian transatlantic drone flight just in time for the Royal Air Tattoo. AOPA drone social tickets are almost gone. We'll go back to talking about Reapers and leaks. Google parent births new business, balloons and drones. FAA news. Drone regulations, of course, and a video of the week and some listener mail. I guess we should get started, huh, Max?
Let's get started, David.
Well, our first story is actually breaking news. It actually finished up the day we're recording this on July 12th, 2018. And this is from the BBC. The first ever transatlantic drone flight lands in the UK. General Atomics MQ-9B Sky Guardian flew from here in the States over to England.
Yeah, quite a long flight. Now, this was 3,760 nautical miles from the Grand Sky Park at the Grand Forks Air Force Base in North Dakota, and they flew to the Royal Air Force Fairford at Gloucestershire in the UK, and they did that in 24 hours and 2 minutes.
And you did some math, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, you all out there, you can check my math, but I believe 3,760 nautical miles is the equivalent of 4,327 miles, and at 24 hours and 2 minutes, actually, I calculated it based on 24 hours. My math tells me that they averaged 180 miles an hour for that entire trip. But, you know, the headline, David, says first transatlantic drone flight. But as you mentioned, this is really the first civilian registered drone to make that flight.
Okay, let's put this in perspective. The MQ-9B Sky Guardian is an upgraded version of the MQ-9 Reaper. Or Predator B, which it's updated for the Royal Air Force. However, it's a delivery flight, so it would be having U.S. November codes on it. So it technically is the first integration into flying the pond with all of the airline traffic that occurs during that time of day. And the reason why it was arriving today was it's partly the celebration of the Royal Air Force 100th anniversary. And this weekend, starting on July 13th, which is Friday, the day week we record this, is the Royal International Air Tattoo, which is a military air show that occurs every year, and then followed by the Farnborough Air Show.
Well, this drone is produced by General Atomics, or maybe more completely, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, Inc. And David, is this a drone that's intended for non-military customers as well?
The Predator B is the civilian version of the Reaper, which is a downgraded non-weapons carrying aircraft. This actually is a military version of it, upgraded for the Royal Air Force. And the only reason why it's civilian was General Atomics was delivering it to the Royal Air Force. Once it's in service with them, it will be technically a military armed medium altitude, long endurance aircraft.
And this is the Sky Guardian, but they also have a Sea Guardian as well, don't they?
Yeah, the Sea Guardian is got a different suite of electronics. The Sea Guardian will be able to, it is for sea surveillance, kind of like our Navy Tritons based on the Global Hawk. This would be a naval version or a maritime surveillance version of the Reaper airframe.
All right. Are there any significant differences between the two other than, you know, maybe the, I don't know, the sensor suite or that sort of thing? I mean, they're fundamentally the same aircraft, are they?
The aircraft has gone through several upgrades. The noticeable thing that this aircraft has over a standard United States Air Force MQ-9 Reaper would be it has upswept wingtips, so it's got winglets. So that's how you can tell a Sky Guardian versus a standard Predator B, or in this case, a Reaper, depending upon what, if it's civilian. The Predator Bs are the versions that are flown by the Customs and Border Protection and NASA, whereas they're the civilian versions of the military Reaper.
And this was remotely piloted by General Atomics out of North Dakota, right? Somebody sitting in a little room someplace flew this the entire route, I guess.
Absolutely. It was more than one person. Usually you're only allowed to fly for 8 hours. And in this case, it was semi-autonomous. So basically they were monitoring the aircraft as it was flying its mission profile. But it flew for 24 hours, but it's capable of up to 40 hours. It could have gone even longer as far as time in the air goes, but with fuel and distance, it's still flying a transatlantic flight with a turboprop aircraft. It's kind of impressive.
Yeah, yeah. Medium altitude, long endurance.
Male.
There we go.
So let's move on to an upcoming event for a lot of people in North America, which is EAA Air Venture. And our friends at AOPA are going to have a seminar on July 27th, 5:30 to 8 p.m. And it's sponsored by Precision Hawk. So it's going to be a drone social. So if you're in the area that night at Oshkosh or EAA or Air Venture, stop by between 5:30 and 8 p.m. and talk shop.
Now, they're looking for folks to pre-register for this event, right? And we have a link that we'll put in the show notes that will allow you to register for that event. I don't know if they take walk-ins. I'm guessing maybe not, but look for the link where you can register if you're able to attend.
It should be fun. And I have a feeling that if you showed up and said you're a drone lover, they'll take it. And the nice thing about it is it's good for AOPA and EAA to integrate UASs into the experimental aircraft universe. Oshkosh, of course, is an amazing air show. You go 1 year for the aircraft, then you go back for the people. But it's a good way to get pilots comfortable with UASs. So good for AOPA and Air Venture for opening up their arms and endorsing unmanned aviation.
Yeah, this is a big thing. This is really great. It's good to see. You know, you could think that the manned aviation organizations like AOPA and EAA might not look too fondly on drones, but AOPA certainly is, and EAA have viewed it differently. Viewed it as sort of another type of aircraft that's going to share the airspace. And so better to embrace it, understand it, work together to make the airspace safe rather than kind of push it aside as something else. And then also generating new pilots, the hope is that some people will start with drones. We know that people have started with RC aircraft as youngsters, for example, and then developed an interest in aviation and progressed on to become pilots. And hopefully the same is true for drones.
And I'll be selfish. If you're there on July 27th, send us a little message about what it's like. Just record it in your phone and send us a little shout out. So because Max and I won't be there this year, but we'd love to hear some feedback on how it was and everything that went on there. So because we do like Precision Hawk and AOPA, they're both friends of our show, so we'd love to hear some more from there.
Yeah.
So let's go talking more about the Reaper. I feel like I should be doing a Australian band song, Don't Fear the Reaper, but evidently someone hacked into a captain's computer for a Reaper, causing the MQ-9A maintenance and course material and weapons were downloaded.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. It comes to us from a threat intelligence firm that's called Recorded Future. And we'll put a link to their blog post in the show notes, which is Military Reaper Drone Documents Leaked on the Dark Web. And what Recorded Future does, among other things, is they monitor the dark web looking for criminal activities. And a unit of Recorded Future identified an attempted sale, they say, of what they believe to be highly sensitive U.S. Air Force documents. And they said specifically, an English-speaking hacker claimed to have access to export control documents pertaining to the MQ-9 Reaper. And the analysts engaged the hacker, confirmed the validity of the compromised documents. They've even identified the name and country of residence of this guy or of the group that they believe is responsible. As for the Air Force captain involved in this, Recorded Future said that the captain whose computer was compromised recently completed the cyber awareness challenge and should have been aware of the required actions to prevent unauthorized access, in this case, setting the FTP password. So, you know, sometimes it's a little simple thing and you have access. But I guess this kind of information or information of military interest does get captured and is for sale out there by the bad guys.
Okay. It's only been like that for hundreds upon thousands of years. There's always somebody who's trying to spy on the enemy to get their technology, be it chariots or Reapers. This is nothing new. It's just the technology is different. But it is kind of funny that he just passed the course on how to secure the information, and it's the one that gets hacked. The following his advertisement for the Reaper drone documents, the threat actor put on yet another set of military documents up for sale. Unfortunately, this time the source was never disclosed to Recorded Future. However, judging by the content, they appear to be stolen from the Pentagon or from U.S. Army official. So lock your laptops, folks, and password protect them, because you never know what's going to get hacked.
Yeah, that's for sure. I wonder if this was a personal laptop in this case. If it was, I don't believe that, you know, those kind of sensitive documents or export control documents should be on people's personal computers. On the personal computers of government employees. And if it was a government computer, then, man, if those things aren't locked down and controlled, then I don't know, man, we're in bad shape. But yeah, you're right. This sort of thing happens all the time.
Well, I guess this is your expertise. Export control documents. How back in the day, how did you secure them? with paper locked in filing cabinets, right?
Well, you can have electronic versions of them, but they have to be marked as such so that the person who has possession of them understands that they're export controlled, and you don't allow them to exist on personal computers, only on company computers. And the company computers are controlled. Something like an FTP transmission of documents and so forth is that's not the right way to do it. You need to have it locked down and encrypted. But you like to hope that the people who have documents like this kind of data, understand these things. But again, over and over, we see that they don't. It's kind of scary.
And as always, it always seems like the bad guys are one step ahead of the good guys.
Yeah. And it's not like with just these documents, they have the keys to the secrets. But the way intelligence works is you slowly amass little bits and pieces of data, any one of which isn't really all that valuable. But taken together, they paint a much larger and much more complete picture. So sometimes when you see the reaction being, they were export controlled, but they weren't classified. Well, yeah, it's a little piece of a puzzle somebody has, and you assemble enough pieces and you can see the whole puzzle. So, but we have other more fun things to talk about.
I was going to say, we've gone down this road of how to protect your data. So let's talk about, ironically, Google, if you're talking about protecting your data. Google's parent, which is Alphabet, births new businesses, balloons and drones. I think we've talked about X, their research lab, before. But what has Alphabet done besides rise to the letter of the occasion?
Well, what they've done is they've taken two projects that were, to this point, managed out of that research laboratory X, and they've created for real business units out of them under Alphabet, not under the research lab. And the two projects are Wing and Loon. And I think we've talked about both of them before. Wing is the delivery drone project.
It is. It's a fixed wing vertical takeoff and landing drone with 12 rotors. It's a fixed wing, but it's got those long extensions so it can take off and land vertically.
And we've seen that they've been testing these Wing drones in Australia last year in 2017. They've actually made some deliveries with them. So you might ask, well, what's the significance? It's a project they've had for some time. They've been making these deliveries. Is this just a sort of a corporate shuffling of the deck chairs, if you will? And the answer is no. I mean, it's come out of the research lab, and now it's a full-fledged project or business unit, actually, under Alphabet. So the signal that sends is that Google is very serious about deliveries by drone. And then Loon we've talked about also, and this will sound fairly familiar. Loon is the high altitude balloon project. This is where they provide internet connectivity in areas that lack that.
Persistent satellites. Mm. And basically, you have a barrage balloon that sends up an antenna, so you have wireless internet. And it's been delivering internet in Brazil and New Zealand, as well as Peru and Puerto Rico after floods and Hurricane Maria. Hmm. So it's a way of providing internet to disaster areas because you assume that all of the antennas and the internet connectivity is down.
And so while we've seen that Facebook has exited this idea, Google seems to be very interested in it.
And yeah, it's funny, ironic that we talked about this last week with Facebook exiting it. But I think if you talk about, for at least the persistent satellites, Google took a more simpler approach than what Facebook did. Facebook had a solar flying wing with solar panels on the top of it. Loon is a much simpler project where you use the balloon and with that has solar cells and provides the activity. So I can understand why that's moving forward, and Facebook sort of shot the moon and didn't get close.
Hmm. Yeah, this does feel like it would have a much lower cost, or at least the development cost would be much lower than what Facebook was trying to do. Maybe there's some other issues with maneuverability with the Facebook concept, you know, the fixed wing. You can fly that, I guess, exactly where you need it. The approach with a balloon, I don't know. Maybe these are tethered balloons. I just don't recall.
They are. They are tethered balloons. So, I mean, it's, you got to run the antenna. The tether is also the antenna. It's a more practical thing. But
yeah,
let's move on to this week in FAA news. FAA says avoid drone registration schemes. I think we talked about this in the past.
It does ring a bell. I think this is a repeat of a warning that the FAA issued once before, and they talk about that there's folks out there who are offering to help people that own or operate drones file an application for a registration number. And sometimes they even mimic the FAA website. Sometimes they even use the FAA logo to try to convince you that this is something really official. But as we know, David, paying someone to register you is really not necessary.
Yeah, and when in doubt, go to FAA.gov. The worst part about it is even these are becoming phishing schemes. We've got a theme here about data privacy, and there's no reason why you can't register your own drone. It's a very simple process. Even Max and I did it. So it's...
Yeah, and if we can do it, anybody can, right?
That's right. I mean, we're just podcasters, you know. But in all fairness, it's a very simple process, and the FAA has gone out of their way to keep it a simple process. So you having to pay for somebody else to do it for you is a waste of your time, money, and maybe some information staring. So we'll have links to the show notes, but $5, FAA Drone Zone, and you can register there, and we'll have a link to the show notes so you can register your own drone and save some money.
Yep.
So, Max, our next story is from Bloomberg.com. Drone regulations in the U.S. withstand a hobbyist legal challenge. I still have mixed emotions about this.
Well, you all might remember that last year in episode 195, we talked about the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit struck down the FAA's drone registration requirement for recreational UAV operators. And you remember that this individual, John A. Taylor, had argued that the FAA requirement for registration violated the 2012 FAA Modernization and Reform Act, in that it was kind of hands-off. The FAA was not allowed to regulate hobbyist drones in certain situations. Since then, Congress passed a law allowing registration of hobbyist drones, but Taylor was back arguing that all hobbyists, not just those exempted by Congress, should be exempt from the law and shouldn't have to register. But the court didn't agree.
I think registration is here to stay. Even for us Academy of Model Aeronautics people who fly radio-controlled aircraft, it's $5, guys. Just bite the bullet and register your RC airplane. You can do it through FAA Drone Zone, like we said in the previous article. I think it's going to be a fact of life. So, I mean, for safety of the airspace as well as your safety, you know, and so I think drone registration is here for the good of all of us, even though it may seem a bit tedious and nonsensical to a hobbyist.
Yeah, and there are many organizations that have been pushing for this, pushing for registration of drones by hobbyists for recreational use. And the argument generally is that if we're all going to share the same airspace, then we have to know who everybody is. And that's where registration comes in. But I think I agree with you, David, that this is not the big battle. There may be other battles in the future, but I don't think this is the big battle we should fight.
Agreed.
We have a video of the week, David.
We do. This being the week after 4th of July, we have a video from Travis Air Force Base, the Intel Shooting Star Drone Light Show. I guess you and I can't get enough of drone swarms doing firework displays. We seem to favor them a lot.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. But, as I was watching this, I saw some displays that were sort of reminiscent of conventional fireworks. But to me, it didn't quite have the dramatic effect that fireworks traditionally have. It made me think of, you're not going to believe this, the old dot matrix printers. You could print graphic images, but they were pretty coarse. The resolution was kind of low. And this display with the drones, it kind of made me think back to that. Low resolution. Maybe there'll be a day when there'll be more drones or, different drones in different clusters so that you don't have to wait so long after one display for the drones to fly around, rearrange themselves, and then light up again for the next display. I think that with these examples we've seen, they are spectacular. They're technologically pretty impressive. But I guess my conclusion is that we're just at the start of this, and that these things are just going to keep getting better and bigger and more impressive. And I think when they do that, I think we'll see that being employed more and more for celebrations than conventional fireworks. But that's my view on it.
You mentioned dot matrix printing, and all I can think of is where I would love to be right now, which is sitting in the backseat of a T6 Texan dot matrix printing with my Skytypers. So, but we got some feedback from our friend Tim Trott, the drone professor, and this was from Skyward and Matt Finelli, director of strategy. This is kind of disturbing news from the FAA.
Yeah, this letter says, quote, "We have learned from the FAA that due to complications with inconsistent ownership boundaries on UAS facility maps, the FAA has decided to temporarily turn off LANCE capabilities at the following airports." And there's six of them: Dulles Love Field, DAL, William P. Hobby Airport, that's in Houston, Dulles International, Baltimore Washington International, Newark Liberty International, EWR, and LaGuardia Airport. And the letter says the FAA is actively working on a solution to bring LANCE back to these areas. If you do frequent business in any of these regions, we suggest applying for a wide area authorization as soon as possible. It's kind of an unexpected glitch in the LANCE program.
What I thought was interesting was Newark and LaGuardia, but not JFK, Dulles and BWI, but not Reagan Washington National, and Dallas and Hobby in Texas. It's kind of, we've got two out of three on what I would say would be high density areas, and the New York corridor, the DC corridor, but not complete. So I'd like to know a little bit more about what the details were about why they were having these issues at these various airports, but not like for not national and not JFK. When this list came out, that was what I was thinking. It's like, okay, what are we missing?
That's a good observation, David. It does sound like there's more to this. And I don't know if this is a problem just unique to these particular areas, or if there's some broader structural issue at play here, and whether we'll see this happen in other regions as well. Don't know. Yeah, there's a lot more information, I think, to be learned here. But we appreciate Tim passing that along. He reproduces this letter in a blog post on his site. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, and you can check that out. All right. Well, David, I think that's all we've got for this episode. We want to thank everyone for listening to the UAV Digest. You can find us at the UAVDigest.com. There you'll find show notes, other resources of interest. Of course, if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, they're at the UAVDigest.com/251.
And of course, we have a social media presence, a small one. You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, on our website, which is the UAVDigest.com, on our Slack listener team, where you can get up to date on news and places where David's messed up. And that's where a lot of our fun occurs. So you can do that by sending us a request at feedback@theuavdigest.com. And we'll send you a link to become part of the private party, Cross the Ropes. And you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/theuavdigest. You can, if you're on Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, leave some feedback for us. That way other people can find us. And you can purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. So with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.